This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been almost 3 years since the ink dried on a huge legal settlement between the state of New Hampshire and groups supporting people with mental illness. The agreement, signed in late 2013, came after advocates sued, charging the state's system of care had deteriorated to the point where patients' civil rights were being violated. Rather than duke it out in court, New Hampshire agreed to make major improvements and to have its progress tracked with reports every 6 months. But the author of the latest of these updates sounds extremely frustrated, writing, "The time for patience is over." Today in The Exchange, what's still missing from our mental health system? Let's hear from you. How would you answer that question? And what progress do you see being made? The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests in studio. With us is Sue Ellen Griffin, Executive Director of West Central Behavioral Health in Lebanon, President of the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association. And Sue Ellen, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Also with us, Jeffrey Myers, Commissioner of New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's been in that role since February. Before that, he was the Director of Intergovernmental Affairs for DHHS. And Commissioner Myers, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura.
And also with us, Ken Norton, Executive Director of the New Hampshire Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And Ken, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for inviting NAMI New Hampshire back.
Well, and Ken, I want to start with you. Just give us the backstory, please, on what drove this lawsuit in the first place.
Well, what drove the lawsuit was, 25 years ago, we were rated number one in the country and in mental health services. And over time, when you're number one, if you don't do anything to really work to stay there, you slip back. And between budget cuts and different challenges that the state faced, we continued to slip back to the point where the lack of community services was really what drove the lawsuit. And frequent admissions to New Hampshire Hospital, some of our older adult residents being put to Glencliff, which is the nursing home way up in the North Country, and people feeling that those ages were becoming younger and younger and people were really sort of being put out to pasture. So those were some of the drivers of the lawsuit.
It's sort of a story of institutionalization, deinstitutionalization, and then reinstitutionalization, Ken, right? I mean, if you look over the past, 40 or 50 years, go ahead.
That's very well put. I mean, I think that what we've seen is it's a pendulum swing. And one of the reasons that New Hampshire became number one is because we were late to deinstitutionalization. And so we learned from the mistakes and the successes that other states had. And we were able to build a system that that was really moving in the right direction and had a lot of those key components in place. But we, kind of fell off of that track and lost our way. And in doing so, then, really slipped in terms of the services we were providing.
So in the 70s, I think it was, Ken, people with mental illness were taken out of basically these big state hospitals and so forth around the country. And the idea was, let's have a system of community-based care where people can get care close to home, close to family, better opportunity for employment, better opportunity for success in life and so forth. So that's sort of phase two. And then as that system broke down, people with mental illness started showing up in prisons, jails, state hospital, hospital emergency rooms, and so forth.
Yes. To put it in a historical perspective, in 1957, when the population of the state was 750,000, we had 2,500 adults at New Hampshire Hospital when it was in its heyday. Now here we are 50 years later, our population's 1.3 million. The adult census is 162, I think. Actually, that includes 168, includes children. So to your point, yes, many people have successfully transitioned in the community, have done well, but many people have not. We've seen increased rates of homelessness, incarceration, and people struggling.
Well, and Sue Ellen Griffin, I'd love to get your thoughts on this sort of trajectory that we're painting, this backdrop
to the lawsuit and how it came to be. You're executive director of West Central Behavioral Health. So that's that community health agency that's supposed to be the key to success for people.
That's right. We're one of 10 community mental health centers in the state of New Hampshire, and we offer mental health services to a multitude of people, all ages, and we offer services for primarily mentally ill people and substance abuse, which often is it's a comorbid disorder. So we do the active treatment in the community for these folks that were discharged from these inpatient hospitals. And so it really is an infrastructure, a safety net for those folks that were discharged out of the hospital.
So when people were discharged, again, in this era of deinstitutionalization, groups like yours were supposed to pick them up and help them out. And did that work at first?
Yes, it did. And I think so much of it's around the economics of the whole structure. In the beginning, the community mental health centers were funded by what's called block grants. So they were given a certain amount of money to actually provide the necessary services to those patients that were discharged. So actually the system did work quite well. Over the years, as we know, interest in mental health and substance use disorders waxes and wanes with politics and with the communities. And so when the economics changed and all of a sudden those block grants were no longer available, the whole structure started to crumble.
How do people pay when they come to your organization to get mental health care?
So primarily insurance, primarily Medicaid. But the community mental health centers do take insurance, Medicare, self-pay. People are treated if they arrive at our centers regardless of the ability to pay. So we do subsidize a fair number of people that have no ability to pay.
Well, and Commissioner Myers, again, you're new to this role. And as I said before, you were director of intergovernmental affairs for DHHS. So I'm going to ask you to reflect on the history from an outsider's perspective, just coming in, not steeped in these issues like Sue Ellen and Ken. How do you view this whole sort of fall from grace that Ken Norton described? We used to be number one in terms of mental health care, and now we're not doing so well.
Yeah, I don't think the fall from grace was intentional at all. One of the things that's needs to be talked about is the change in the models of care that have occurred over that time. When deinstitutionalization started occurring, I think, across the country, states were looking at services in the community, but they were focused more on group homes. And if you look at the department's 10-year mental health plan, which was as recent as 2008, it talked about group homes. But the models of care and the best evidence and the science supporting care for mental health treatment has evolved significantly over time, particularly in this time period, with a real emphasis now on much more intensive type of community-based treatments like the so-called assertive community treatment teams, the so-called ACT teams. And another model which is referred to and which is being established under the current settlement, mobile crisis teams, where there are teams of professionals, psychiatrists and other mental health professionals that are able to intervene quickly with a person who's in crisis and actually house them. There are crisis apartments that go with those mobile crisis teams. So there's been a real evolution, if you will, in this time period to different forms of community treatment. That's one of the reasons why we may have fallen behind a little bit. I think the other relevant fact here is that since the 70s and 80s, there's been a number of economic challenges, not just in New Hampshire, but throughout the country. We went through a very significant recession in the early 90s. We went through a very deep recession, 2009-2010, where the state here and across the country, states had to make very difficult choices in how they were able to fund services at that time. So we're recovering still from that time period.
Let me give out the phone number, invite people to join us, and then lots more questions, especially about what this settlement involves, what the progress looks like, why the expert involved in overseeing this sounded so frustrated when he released his report recently. Again, we're looking at New Hampshire's mental health system after a legal settlement almost 3 years ago and the major improvements that the state agreed to make, why a recent report says progress has been far too slow. Join us with your questions and comments. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We want your questions, comments, thoughts, concerns, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. So, Ken, without getting into too much detail, what were the big ticket items that this settlement spelled out that said, okay, we, the state of New Hampshire, agree to do X, Y, and Z?
Well, they were there were several. One, as Commissioner Myers mentioned, was assertive community treatment teams, or ACT teams. And that's a very a service that's supposed to be 24/7 and 7 days a week, that's multidisciplinary, meaning that there's a social worker and a psychiatrist and a nurse and a case manager and a peer person who wrap around the person to make sure that their community tenure is stable. And then there is supported housing, which was another category, meaning to provide them supports necessary to live independently in apartments. And there was supported employment. Like anybody else, vocational is really key to people with mental illness and their recovery process, and to give them meaning in their life and something to look forward to. And mobile crisis response was the last category. And mobile crisis response is rather than people coming to the emergency department, a team comes to them. And again, a peer component being an important part of that. And then the other piece was relative to the Glencliff home and transitioning people who are at the Glencliff home back into a community setting rather than Glencliff.
Now, just remind us what Glencliff is, because that's not as familiar to listeners as New Hampshire Hospital. A lot of people know that that's sort of the last resort psychiatric unit, if I could put it that way. But a lot of people don't know Glencliff.
Glencliff was a tuberculosis sanatorium back in the day at the turn of the century. Beautiful up on the edge of Mount Moosilauk, and
quite remote.
Quite
I passed
remote.
It once, yes. on the way to a hike, and I was surprised at how out of the way it was.
It's extremely remote. And, you know, and part of that was with tuberculosis, you wanted people to be in the fresh air and away from from everybody. But it has been used as sort of the last stop for people from New Hampshire Hospital as they get elderly and infirmed and they have complex medical needs in addition to psychiatric needs. And the psychiatric needs rising to a level that regular nursing homes or county nursing homes would not be willing to take them.
Sue Ellen, what were your hopes when this settlement was signed, again, at the end of 2013?
The community mental health centers hoped that we would rebuild our infrastructure. Unfortunately, the mental health agreement is not the total solution. We're focusing on it. We need to address it. We need to, you know, make sure that we stand up the services, and we're willing to do that. But we just want to make sure that people are aware that this is not the be-all and the end-all. We have more work to do around the infrastructure of the mental health system.
So even if the settlement, and again, we'll get into the details of it in just a minute, even if it were, you know, completed 100%, A+, there'd still be things lacking.
Absolutely.
Such as?
Such as the number of inpatient beds that we have. As long as our people are still sitting in the emergency rooms of hospitals across the state, then we need to make sure that we build appropriate resources. And so while we're talking about making sure that people don't languish on inpatient services, either at Glencliff or at New Hampshire Hospital, we do have to make sure that there's an appropriate number of beds for people that might have an acute situation.
An acute situation meaning they're in crisis.
They're in crisis.
And there's no place for them to go.
That's correct.
Except, you know, the emergency room at any local hospital where somebody else is there for a broken leg, and that's not appropriate.
Where they may spend days
right
before they're actually treated and hospitalized appropriately.
Commissioner Myers?
Thank you. I want to emphasize what Sue Ellen is saying now, because I think the department and the state view the settlement as just the starting point. The community mental health agreement is just the starting point in terms of how we are going to rebuild our mental health system in New Hampshire. Another very important point about the agreement is that it really looks to services for adults, but not kids.
Kids aren't really covered by that. Severely lacking in terms of what's available.
And as Ken knows, and as I'm sure many listeners know, there are too many kids over too many days that are waiting in ED departments for admission for inpatient mental health services, and that's something that's very, very important to the department.
Did you want to finish up there, Mr.
Yeah,
Myers?
Yes. I want to emphasize that the department and the state are committed to the implementation of this agreement. And we are working very hard to ensure, working with the legislature, working with the governor, to ensure that the funding for the implementation is there, that we are working collaboratively with the community mental health centers and others. But as I said, this is just a piece of it. For example, in addition to the money that is appropriated by the legislature for the implementation of this settlement, New Hampshire pursued last year and was awarded by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services a funding opportunity. And it has a very technical Washington-type name.
It's a big pot of money, though, $150 million.
It's $150 million. And what it is under the federal Medicaid statute, the Secretary of Health and Human Services in Washington is allowed to match health care spending by states and by local communities if the secretary that are not otherwise available traditionally for a match, if the secretary determines that that additional federal match would further the goals and interests of the Medicaid program. So in New Hampshire, the state applied with the leadership of the governor and the legislature and the department applied for $150 million, what's called a 1115 waiver. And Section 1115 is the section of the Medicaid statute that grants the secretary the authority to do this.
So basically, we got a lot of money, $30 million over the next 5 years. What are we going to do with that?
Well, what we're doing with it, first of all, this funding opportunity is focused solely on the behavioral health system in New Hampshire.
Meaning the mental health
system. So mental health and substance use disorder combined. And it is specifically intended to increase capacity, to promote integration of services, for example, SUD services and mental health services with primary care and acute medical care, so that when an individual goes to their primary care physician and they have a substance use disorder need or they have a mental health need, there is really the capacity and ability for that primary care physician to supply that. Maybe not themselves for all services, but there's integration in our medical and our healthcare system in New Hampshire that promotes the delivery of mental health services and substance use disorder services along with medical care. And so what the state is doing, we've established 7 regions in the state. There are groups of providers who will be working together in new ways. So these are existing providers, including the hospitals, community mental health centers, substance use disorder providers, and many others, physicians, physician-owned practices, as an example, who will be undertaking projects starting later this year to basically promote that integration and increase that capacity. So some of this money is going to be there to address some of the workforce issues, which we should talk about this morning.
Well, thank
you for saying
that. Yes.
But the bulk of the money is performance-based, so it's not a grant. It has to be earned by meeting metrics every year, but that money will be there for services.
Well, I'm so glad you said staffing, because Ken Norton, from what I understand, you know, there's money, there's energy, there's focus, there's excitement. But from what I have read, there are not enough people to fill the jobs that it's going to take to make this successful.
Yes, we've had workforce capacity issues across the system that are a significant challenge. And, you know, I think people have heard recently there was a dispute relative to contracts for psychiatrists and prescribers at New Hampshire Hospital. Last year it was relative to nurses and nursing shortages at New Hampshire Hospital, but in the community as well. The community has probably over 140 vacancies, and a new Department of Labor law relative to overtime, it can have significant impact, and that will come into effect in December.
We'll talk a little bit more about the shortage of people to fill these jobs in just a moment. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at New Hampshire's mental health system. After a legal settlement reached almost 3 years ago, the state agreed to make major improvements. But progress has been far too slow, according to a recent report. We're finding out this hour what's being done and what isn't being done. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What's your perspective on the health of New Hampshire's mental health system? What improvements have you seen? What more remains to be done? We'd love to hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can always find us on Facebook or Twitter. Commissioner Jeffrey Myers is with us. He's head of New Hampshire's Department of Health and Human Services. He's been in that role just since February. Ken Norton is here, executive director of the New Hampshire chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Sue Ellen Griffin is with us, executive director of West Central Behavioral Health in Lebanon and president of the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association. And with us now is Jack Rodolico, NHPR's health reporter, who's been covering this topic. And Jack, welcome. Good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
And I want to fold you into our conversation. I know you were listening before, but I wonder what you hear as you're out reporting, you know, in the community on what people are seeing and not seeing in terms of reaching the goals of this mental health settlement.
I think one of the sadder components of this is that as a newsroom, we get emails pretty regularly. I get them directly and then we'll get them to all the reporters from people who have their own story. And the elements of the story are always pretty similar. They have a loved one who has a serious mental health crisis. Sometimes it's depression. I feel like I've heard depression a couple times, where you know they try to get to the psychiatrist and they can't, or they get an appointment 2 months out. And so in that interim time, somebody becomes suicidal or they spiral, and then they go into a hospital. And you know, a medical hospital isn't 100% equipped to deal with somebody in a psychiatric crisis. So then they're in for a little bit, and then they come out, or maybe they go to New Hampshire Hospital and then they come out. But when they come out, they might not have the supports back home. I know of at least two people who have had loved ones who died in trying to get mental health care. There's a number of complicating factors in there. You know, you can't entirely blame the mental health system for that. But, you know, there are really serious consequences when people cannot find care for their loved ones. And, you know, we've heard this before, but I've talked with families whose I talked with one family with a teenage girl who was suicidal, who got stuck in an emergency room for 11 days.
11 days.
So just think about, you know, you think about if you're in a psychiatric crisis already, and then if anyone has gone to an emergency room, it's a bit torturous in itself, just waiting hours for a doctor to come and see you. Some people get boarded there for over a week waiting to get into New Hampshire Hospital. So there are these really serious consequences. People actually get sicker waiting for care.
Well, sure. It's very stressful. You're in this Concord Hospital anyway.
Yeah.
There's yellow pod.
There's just sort of a
very sterile room and everything's kind of locked down and you're stuck in there and you hear all the weird sounds from the ER and it's very disturbing.
That's right. And if you think about, you know, these families, they get so frustrated because it's almost as though there's no sort of equality in the healthcare system in that, you know, if you get into a car accident, you're treated right away and your condition is treated. You know, if you have a heart attack, your condition is treated right away. If you have a psychiatric crisis, you're not necessarily treated right away. It might take quite a while to find the right care. So I think that's just something that really eats away at people, and it can be pretty demoralizing for these families.
So some people have even died waiting for care, died by suicide.
According to families that I've heard from, that's what they've said.
And
yeah,
occasionally people
two.
Lash out too. The young man who shot two Manchester police officers.
Well,
we
looked a couple of weeks ago. We looked at the five most recent police shootings in New Hampshire. And when I say police shootings, there were four incidents where police fatally shot an individual, and then one incident where an individual shot two police, and everyone survived in that situation. In all of those situations, there were indications that individual had serious mental illness. Most of them, individuals appeared to be suicidal. So, you know, it plays out in all of these different ways that we don't necessarily see every day, but frontline responders, emergency room workers, police officers, I mean, they see this all the time.
Well, I'm so struck by what you say, Jack, and especially, and I'll throw this to you first, Sue Ellen, but want to hear from everybody about how, you know, if you break your leg, you go to the ER, boom, you're treated. Same thing, heart attack. I have been covering the news for a long time, and I've heard politician after politician say we need mental health parity, meaning, you know, you get the same treatment. So what's going on?
I mean, that's absolutely true. And I think that, you know, mental health has never been but it is not likely to be the area that people are comfortable with. It's an uncomfortable topic. And so people tend to you know, move away from it and not engage in it. And it's lack of knowledge and lack of understanding. But I do want to comment on one thing around the mental health victims being perpetrators of crime. Our folks will tend to be the victim of violence more often than the person that is aggressive or hostile or involved in the shootings. And so, unfortunately, mental health gets a very bad rap because you only hear about the people that are causing these kinds of really frustrating and frightening circumstances. And so it continues to perpetuate the stigma around mental illness, meaning that, you know, people are afraid of people that have mental illness, and they have, you know, and they don't have to be afraid of people. And so we do things like in the community mental health system, like teach things like mental health first aid. It's an 8-hour course that we teach people in the community to give them some resources on how to deal with people that may be experiencing some kind of a mental illness or a mental health crisis.
So regular people like me can learn the skills to help somebody who's in a mental health crisis. It's so interesting because I've taken first aid, you know, every other year. I take my CPR and my first aid and all that. But I could learn how to help someone with a mental health crisis. I would think, ooh, I'm not qualified and that's really special. And how could I even begin to, you know, help there?
Absolutely. And actually, the beginnings of the mental health first aid were just that. It was a team, a husband and wife, that created this because they didn't understand, because the wife was in like an EMT and she didn't understand how to deal with a mental health crisis. She said, I know how to deal with other things, but I don't know what to do with people that are in a mental health crisis. And so the program was started actually in Australia, and it's in this country right now. And we alone in this state have trained over 450 individual people across the state.
That's really interesting. Well, speaking of the issue of stigma that Jack mentions and that you mention, Sue Ellen, as a possible reason for people not to have mental health parity, even though we've been talking about it forever, here's an email from Gretchen who says, stigma has been identified as a barrier for both seeking treatment and staying in treatment for people with mental illness and substance use disorders. Gretchen says, are there specific plans by DHHS and community mental health centers to address stigma? Commissioner Myers, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. I think there's been a lot of emphasis, renewed emphasis on the stigma issue. Former Chief Justice John Broderick and others have championed the Change the Direction campaign to bring awareness to the signs from mental illness and intervention for people who are in need of mental health services. The department, and I'm going to give credit to our military liaison, Joe Moncher, has promoted substantially over the last couple of years the Ask the Question campaign. So when because there is a prevalence and there is concern that our veterans get all the care that they need, not just medical care, but mental health and substance use disorder services as well. And so there's a real effort to educate providers and others in New Hampshire so that when they encounter someone, they ask the question. They find out whether someone has served in the military or is a family member of someone who served in the military. It's been a very, very significant outreach campaign the department has promoted.
Can you jump in on this too, Ken Norton? After all these years of everyone rallying for mental health parity, we still see this situation.
I first want to define stigma because we throw that term around and oftentimes we don't really talk about what it means. And really, Jack touched on it when he talked about equality and the lack of equality. And stigma is really discrimination or prejudice that's occurred relative to how mental illness is treated or looked at by society. And it's taken many forms. So it's really it takes forms in terms of limitations of insurance, access to health care, Stigma can be institutional, such as that Medicare has limitations on what it will pay for inpatient treatment, even though nationally we have a law that says that there should be no limitations on that. It can be imposed by the person on themselves in terms of how they perceive themselves as a result of their illness. And that's why really what we're talking about is essentially a civil rights issue, and that's the origins of this lawsuit.
Again, the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're looking at the mental health settlement reached almost 3 years ago, where the state is at with this now. According to a recent report, 1-800-892-6477. And let's go to Karen first in Laconia, all of you. Karen, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks. I worked in a community mental health center as a clinician from 2003 to 2010, working with severe and persistent mental illness. And my observation was that the biggest problems that the clients had were poverty and isolation. I remember in 2003 when the group home was closed, people who were used to that level of support and even supervision for some folks really suffered when they didn't have it anymore. And putting people into the community doesn't integrate them into community by itself. They wound up sort of isolated in terrible apartments in the worst parts of town. They were in the community, but they were not accepted or integrated. And some people really got worse.
So the group home, even though we talk about, you know, deinstitutionalization and not warehousing people, quote unquote, you're saying, Karen, there was some good parts of that, too.
Well, I don't think there's a one size fits all solution. Uh-huh. And it was presented as better for everybody. But it really wasn't, because the level of supports went down so much.
Karen, thank you.
Yeah. You know, some people's symptoms spike at night. And we had instances of folks having terrible psychotic breaks, and they'd go and smash a door in their apartment, get evicted, and once you get evicted, you lose your Section 8. And it was just a nightmare for people with certain needs.
Karen, this is a great point. And Sue Ellen, what do you think? You go first. The idea that, you know, deinstitutionalization, living independently on your own sounds great, but it doesn't work for everybody.
That's absolutely true. And I think our caller brings up a very good point. One size does not fit all. Sometimes this congregate living is really very helpful for people that are lonely or isolated or share, you know, similar issues such as mental illness. They can be very supportive and they can be very healthy. They do jobs around the house. It keeps them busy and integrated. So, you know, the idea that deinstitutionalization is the answer for everybody is not true.
Go ahead, Commissioner Myers.
The agreement that the department is now implementing together with the community mental health centers and others does promote some of the integrated efforts that I think that Karen was referring to. For example, one of the requirements of the agreement, as Ken mentioned earlier, was supported employment, that we provide, that the state provides employment support services to people who have mental health issues so that they can maintain employment and recover from their issues and address their mental health issues so that they do not lose employment.
How hard is it to find employment for some people, to find employers willing to take someone who, you know, has mental health challenges? An employer might think, okay, I'm not really sure about this person. You know, are they going to mess up with my clients and so forth?
Yes, and I think that's an issue that our supportive employment teams work with all the time. A big piece of it, again, is education. Our staff is available to work with our clients when they're employed. And when we talk about supportive employment, I want to be very clear that these are not volunteer jobs. These are jobs where people are paid as anybody else in the community would be paid. They're competitive positions. And they really work side by side with everybody else in the community. So it's an important role that our staff plays with our clients and with the employers, because they continue to educate them, they support them, and it's amazing how well the clients can do when they're out working in the community.
Let's take another call. This is Ann in Hanover. Hi, Ann. Go ahead. You're in the air. Welcome.
Thank you. I was just wondering what the commissioner would say about the long-term plan for rebuilding the mental health infrastructure in New Hampshire and a timeline for things to happen.
Anne, thank you so much. And I think really that's what we're talking about, right, this hour, in addition to the settlement and so forth. I want to hear from everybody, but go ahead, Commissioner Myers.
Thank you very much. I mean, we did have a plan. The department came forward in 2008.
I remember talking to Commissioner Tumpas about
that. Right, right, with a plan to rebuild the system. As I noted a little bit earlier, there were some severe economic challenges in the state that obviously interrupted our efforts to do that. And we are now where we are. I think the plan, and as a department, I think we need, and as a state, I think, I hope that in the course of my tenure as commissioner, we will revisit that long-term plan for mental health services and for the mental health system in New Hampshire. But in the meantime, in response to your caller, what we are doing is working with the legislature and the governor to and the community mental health centers to ensure that there is funding available for the implementation and compliance with the community mental health agreement. And there are areas where we are absolutely making some progress under that agreement. As I mentioned earlier, this new $150 million waiver is going to bring significant resources to the state of New Hampshire to look at the structural issues. I want to come back to workforce because I think everybody recognizes that there are workforce challenges, particularly in the healthcare system in New Hampshire. The governor recognized that and established a commission a number of weeks ago that's going to be meeting till the end of the year to look at healthcare workforce. Senator Woodburn, state senator from up north, sponsored legislation that passed with broad support this year, looking at workforce in the nursing area particularly. So I think there's a real recognition that that's a factor here and that we are going to have to find ways to promote a sustainable workforce for mental health services in New Hampshire.
I just want you all to clarify something for me that I have often wondered. And Jack, I'll turn to you first. You know, there's so much focus on the state needs to do this, the state needs to do that, state funding, state getting some funding from the federal government. What about the private sector? What's the role of private insurers, people paying privately, private hospitals? What's the private sector's responsibility in this?
This is sort of the eternal quagmire of the mental health system in that because of the legacy that the state wants pretty much fully ran the mental health system, right? The state had an asylum for people with mental illness. That was true all across the country. We've never gotten away from that legacy. The state continues to have an obligation to be at the center of a mental health system. So that's true everywhere. That's true. Most states struggle with this issue, and most states struggle from the same problems. Most states struggle from families lacking the care that they need and the state kind of getting in trouble every couple of years. What happens is, you know, we have got psychiatric professionals in the state that work in, you know, you can hang a shingle and open your own practice, or you can work for Dartmouth Hitchcock or another hospital. Many people do, but there is a shortage of psychiatric professionals nationwide, and there's a number of reasons for that. Part of it is that it is, you know, as compared with other medical professions, there's a lot of paperwork in it, and there's a lot of draw towards other medical fields right now. So that's not necessarily going to change if New Hampshire wants to change it. That's a national problem. So the governor's task force is going to try to dig into this. But at the same time, you've still got the state with this outsized role in the mental health system. So let's say right now we've got a big opportunity to get $150 million from the federal government. We've got a commitment from the legislature for a few years because of the lawsuit. What happens in 5 years if the legislature changes their priorities, or 10 years? That's the eternal seesaw of the mental health system.
All right. We'll talk more in just a moment. Thank you for that call. And you can join us as well, 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, developments with mental health care in the Granite State. Delayed progress on one hand, but as we're hearing, increased federal funding on the other. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And all of you, just before the break, we were talking about the private sector and its role. And Ken Norton, next to you, Jack Rodolico explained that given the historic role of states, you know, warehousing people in big institutions who had mental illness, it seems like the legacy is that it is still a public responsibility and private insurers, private hospitals haven't done as much as maybe they could have. I just wonder what you think. If you could just explain why this is always on the state.
Well, I think that part of it is again, going back to stigma, going back to the discrimination relative to insurance coverage and reimbursement rates. It all gets very complicated. But if you look at hospitals in particular, I mean, when we decided to build a smaller state hospital back in the late 80s, it was done on the premise that, regional hospitals would have what were called designated receiving facilities or DRFs, and that there would be a number of them around the state with the intention that people stay in their home community, that they're close to family, they're close to their natural support systems.
So is that like a psychiatric ward in a particular hospital,
yeah,
Cheshire
have...
Medical Center, Concord Hospital? Wherever.
Yep. They would have the ability to admit people involuntarily, similarly to New Hampshire Hospital.
But locally, so they're not far away.
Correct. And we do still have a few of them, but we never achieved and or we, you know, many of them have closed down.
Now, why is that? I just read an article about the impact of Cheshire Medical Center closing a lot of its psychiatric beds and the really hard impact that's had on that region.
I think the conundrum is, as Jack points out, is that, you know, local hospitals, most of them nonprofit, have missions to provide health care for residents of their region. And some of them continue to do that at great cost and to lose significant amount of money while trying to do that. And many others are not and have closed their units and added coronary units or something else because it's more profitable for them.
I see. So bringing in a new heart care unit or diabetes care unit or a while back new fancy birthing units, those bring in the dollars and the psychiatric wards do not.
Yes. And, you know, and some of that's again, mental health services are not well valued and that creates the workforce development because we don't pay people well that work in those professions. We don't reimburse at rates that are on par with rates for other medical illnesses, and it all contributes to this challenge.
But Commissioner Myers, I can see why I jump in. But Ken, just to clarify, these same hospitals have been complaining, have they not, about mental health patients showing up in their emergency rooms?
Yes.
And the costs there. So if they had not closed down the psychiatric wards, I hate to use that word, maybe that's not the right word, but if they had not closed down those units, they might not have these people showing up now in the ER along with the people with the broken legs and the broken arms.
And those are uncompensated costs in the emergency room.
Okay,
and
Commissioner Myers, go ahead.
I want to jump in here because we've taken some important steps in the last year, year and a half with respect to the designated receiving facilities.
Again,
put
that in layperson
terms.
These
are small, usually 10-bed units that treat individuals who are seriously mentally ill. So it's not they are folks that have complex mental health conditions and serious mental health conditions. And I agree that reimbursement rates had been an issue with respect to the state's funding of DRF beds for Medicaid. But we took a very important step about a year and a half ago. We nearly doubled the daily rate for a so-called DRF bed, a designated receiving
bed. So it's not such a money-losing proposition
exactly.
anymore for
and
hospitals.
Those rates are now, I think, around $1,200 a day, if I'm not mistaken. And there's been an increase in the capacity of DRF beds in the state over the last year or so. Franklin Hospital, Lakes Region Community Health Center and Franklin Hospital, who are affiliated, came to the state. The state loaned Franklin some money to stand up a new 10-bed unit in Franklin. That unit is now operating. Portsmouth Hospital got approval from our department open about a 10-bed unit at Portsmouth Hospital.
So these are now coming back.
So there are more now. There are certainly more DRF beds in New Hampshire in the community than there were a couple of years ago. In addition, I want to mention that the state now has opened up at New Hampshire Hospital a 10-bed inpatient stabilization unit that is intended to treat people for short stays. So that, we believe, will have an impact on the number of folks who are waiting for inpatient admission in hospital emergency departments. And we've seen some trends in the last few weeks since the July 5th opening of that 10-bed unit where the numbers of folks waiting in hospital-ED departments are coming down a bit. So, we haven't solved the problem. There's a lot more work to do. But I think this 10-bed unit is having an impact. Franklin's having an impact. The beds in Portsmouth are having an impact. And I think that's all to the good.
And Sue Ellen and Jack want to hear from you, too. But Commissioner Myers, so you're saying, things are starting to get better, starting to open up. And yet, as you know, the report that came out just a week or two ago from the overseer of this legal settlement,
right.
he sounded extremely frustrated, very polite, but basically saying, get on it, folks. We've given you enough time.
There are two areas that the expert reviewer, Steve Day, cited as the state being in compliance with. And I want to make sure we highlight those areas as well. That's the supported employment, where we're meeting our statewide goals, and the Housing Bridge Subsidy Program, which provides monetary subsidies for people who are waiting for Section 8 housing so that the money appropriated for that program pays a portion of their rent so that they can be able to maintain housing while they're waiting for Section 8 housing. There were two areas in particular that the expert reviewer cited us as being out of compliance. One is the capacity of our assertive community treatment teams, the community-based treatment teams that deal with folks kind of an intensive long-term basis, if you will, to manage.
And right there where they are to prevent them from going into the ER.
Exactly. And the transitions from the Glencliff home. So we think we're going to be able to make some progress in both of these areas, and I want to just mention this very quickly. With respect to the Glencliff home, we have identified providers who are Medicaid providers who have the ability to take some of these folks. We are now working with those providers to ensure that we increase the number of transitions at Glencliff so that we come into compliance with that requirement. Secondly, with respect to the ACT teams, we are really looking now at who's showing up in emergency departments and whether they're connected or not connected to an ACT team. And very recently, the department has provided a lot of data for the first time to the community mental health centers as to who's in the ED department connected to the ACT team and who is not. Very specific data as to their clients, if you will. And so we are really drilling down to ensure that we identify those folks who could be help ACT services and those who ACT may not be appropriate for, but we've taken some concrete steps.
So if somebody shows up in the ER in the midst of a psychiatric crisis, okay, it's too bad that these teams weren't there to back them up or didn't find them, but you're trying to make sure that they will be afterwards. So that person doesn't slip through again, at least.
We are looking very closely now at who's showing up in the emergency department so that we can ensure that they get the right type of service.
We've talked a lot about workforce and how there's money now and focus, but not yet the people to fill these critical jobs. Here's an email toward that effect from Beth. She says, on the subject of the mental health workforce, I can speak as a recent graduate now serving in community mental health. Serving, Beth says, is an appropriate word given the intensity of the work and the paucity of compensation. The catch-22 for myself and all my smart, young, energetic colleagues is that most, if not all of us, love, capital letters from Beth, love the populations with whom we work. Families with intense multi-generational needs. But given the costs of our education and the toll of the work we take, we end up feeling like we can't afford to stay in the agencies we first enter as new graduates. We stay long enough to get our supervision hours, and as soon as we can, we find other work. And Beth, wow. She concludes by saying, I can't read the whole thing, but she concludes by saying this turnover in staff at agencies across the state does not best serve the clients of agency. She cares deeply about her clients and brings every bit of passion in me to my work. Beth, thank you so much for this email. And Sue Ellen, what do you think? She's young, energetic, smart, wants to do this work, cares about the people, but it's too hard and there's not enough pay.
And boy, do we love having those young people join our organizations. But she's absolutely right. What happens is these young people, to her point, energetic, smart, coming out of school, and then they join the community mental health centers, and we provide the supervision necessary for them to become licensed or independent practitioners, at which point a fair number of those folks do go out into private practice because it's clearly more lucrative than it is to work in the community mental health centers. So there is one thing that's happening right now, though, as far as the workforce, and that is called tuition forgiveness. And so the community mental health centers can now have up to 3 people in their community mental health center that we can apply for tuition forgiveness.
The whole thing?
No, it's over a 3-year. It's a portion over 3 years, and it changes. It goes down. Actually, the first year is the largest reimbursement, and then it gradually decreases over the next 2 years. But for those 3 years, we've actually retained 3 clinical people that actually said they would have left our agency if we did not have this tuition forgiveness plan. And so that's going to be something that I think is going to help the workforce as we go forward. It's not the long-term plan. It's a short-term solution, but it's something. It's more than what we had before.
What would you say to a young person, just entering college, maybe at the end of high school, Sue Ellen, trying to figure out what to do? It seems that the message so many young people get these days is science, technology, engineering, and math. We're losing ground in high tech to, the South Koreans or whoever. It's time for a high tech career.
That's where
the money is. That's where the focus is. That's where the politicians and the business leaders are talking about.
And actually, I can't sit here and dispute that. I'd like to be able to say that there's a future where people can join our mental health arena and really be able to make lots of money. That's probably not going to be the case in the future. But I think the reality is the work is, as your person wrote in, the work is good work. And people do it because they have a passion and a mission to do this kind of work. And that doesn't mean they should be underpaid. And so I think that we're always trying to advocate for increase in salaries and making sure that we have an infrastructure that can support salary increases and try to improve our workforce because we can pay them more. It will probably never be as lucrative as other professions, but I don't think that we ought to just assume that because you join this profession that you're not going to get paid.
Yeah, you're not taking a vow of poverty. You might not make as much, but maybe the work is incredibly satisfying when you're helping people. Jack and then Ken, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the key thing is it's this distinction that people get into this. If you want to make money, go to Silicon Valley. And that's people know that. So that's where they go. Or Boston, right? Frankly, I mean, there's a lot of high paying jobs in Boston. But if you are dedicated to this kind of work and you're passionate about it, you do it. But then there's the threshold, right? So
Beth seems to be alluding to.
Exactly.
Right.
The passion will only take you so far when you've got, college loans and maybe you're married and maybe you want to have kids and you're right at this point in your life where, you want to start saving some money. I have in my family, I've got social workers. I've got people who work with people with mental illness and substance abuse disorders, and they work crazy hours, and it's really about the passion of it. Sue Ellen, can I just ask you a quick question? Who sets those rates when you've got these young, passionate people coming into the field, and they're going to work at the community mental health center? It would be ideal if they just stuck with you for 20 years and built up some institutional knowledge. Who sets their pay rates?
Actually, the independent organization sets the pay rates, but we do a comparison, and so we do an annual comparison of our rates. And what we can afford to pay people. And so it does go up over time, but it's just a very, very slow process. But we do compare our salaries at different points throughout the year.
And where does your money come from?
Our money comes from reimbursement for services.
From Medicare, Medicaid, private insurers, again, not forgetting about them.
All of those.
And state grants and community grants and so forth.
Primarily the fee-for-service payments.
How is that $150 million that the Department of Health and Human Services managed to get going to help you out at the community level?
That's a very good question that we're still trying to answer. All of us, all of the 10 community mental health centers are involved in our local 1115 waiver group. And so we are now still trying to define how that money will actually flow down to the community mental health centers in some way to potentially help with this kind of workforce effort. So it's yet to be known, but we are actively engaged in our local regions.
Yeah, it's great to hear from you, Beth. Thank you so much for the email. Hold on, Commissioner Myers, I just want to let Ken Norton jump in there. Go ahead, Ken.
I want to thank Beth for her dedication. And people like Beth. But I want to point out that mental illness, like other illnesses, has a trajectory. And for some people, it may be acute, meaning it's a very short-term duration. But for other people, it may be very long-term. And for those people that it's long-term for, when their staff person turns over their therapist for their family members, whoever, every 2 years, it really impacts on the ability to promote recovery.
Sure. And Beth alludes to that, saying, turnover at staff at agencies across the state does not best serve clients. So, Beth, again, thank you for bringing your thoughts to this discussion. Go ahead, Commissioner Myers.
Community mental health centers provide a lot of services to those that are on Medicaid and enrolled in managed care, not just those that are in a fee-for-service program. And one of the things that the state does, obviously, from time to time, is set the rates for the reimbursement of mental health services that are within the capitated rate, within the overall per-member, per-month rate that is set for those who participate in managed care. So in New Hampshire, it's roughly 139 or 140,000 individuals. I can tell you that in establishing the rates for the next fiscal year, for this new fiscal year, which happens to coincide with the last year of the MCO contracts, we set rates in, to try to reflect some of the workforce challenges.
So pay's going up, basically.
So the amount of money, there's going to be $82 million available for services. That's an increase from what it was in the prior year.
Wow. Well, lots more to talk about. Jack Verdelico, real quickly. So we just got the latest progress report. What are you going to be looking at for the next one?
There are some deadlines set for August 1st, actually. So they're supposed to come every 6 months or so. So there were a number of deadlines set out over the course of months. So we'll just see how the state does.
Okay. Yeah. Jack Verdelico, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And Ken Norton, thank you. Good to see you.
Thank you for having me.
And Sue Ellen Griffin, good to meet you, too. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Commissioner Myers, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. The senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Knoy.